When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. My name is Anthony, and I don't mind saying that I think this may be my favorite episode of Electric Boogaloo coming up. It's got everything that I like about doing this project. I really like narrowing the scope and really looking at the minutiae of the text at times, and then widening the scope to see big picture stuff, like bringing in meta conversations from time to time. This episode includes Jan Doolittle-Wilson. She's one of my favorite conversation partners, just to narrow in on particular details. Jan is an expert on gender studies and disability studies, and she teaches classes on Game of Thrones at the University of Tulsa. You get to hear Steve's shock and awe over the purple wedding. It totally took him by surprise, and I got to experience that episode anew through his eyes, which is always fun. And I do a little bit of meta conversation. So without further ado, here is Jan Doolittle-Wilson. This is quite an action-packed and bloody chapter.
It is. It's actually one of my favorites. When you told me this is the one we would be discussing, I was excited.
Oh, okay. That's I'm so glad to, that you said that. So why? Why is it among your favorites?
It's an overlooked but incredibly important section, I think, in Tyrion's story arc. And, you know, revisiting this, it reminded me of how this chapter really illustrates all of the kind of qualities and strategies and forms of agency that Tyrion has really spent a lifetime honing, you know, just out of sheer necessity. Mm-hmm. But also we're starting to see the beginning of something else here as well. And so you kind of have this accumulation of what we're starting to learn about Tyrion, mm-hmm. how he has been able to survive in a world that is incredibly cruel and discriminatory and has, you know, cast him out his entire life.
Yeah.
But we also see the privileges that he has and how he is able to wield them to obviously tremendous effect, not only to survive, but to show agency. But then we also start to see another side of Tyrion, which is he's actually quite brave and he's actually extremely resourceful in a battle situation, which you wouldn't initially think he would be. And that will be a very prominent theme for Tyrion going forward. So it's just this beautiful, I think, kind of combination of what we're learning, what we've seen, what he's done in the past, but also it's a lot of looking forward as well. It's just a really beautiful chapter in so many ways. And it hints at Tyrion's dark side as well. You know, as the books go on, Tyrion gets darker and darker and darker. Yeah. And you see some of that here.
I think that you could read Tyrion up until this point as something of a survivor.
Yes.
And I mean that in a couple ways. First off, he mentions at one point, comparing the Westerosi culture to Dothraki culture, that if he had been born in a different part of the world to a different tribe, he might have not survived his infancy.
Right.
So he's a survivor in that way. But for the most part, in most of his life, and we imagine he's in his early 30s or something like that, he's really a sort of a social survivor.
Yes.
Like he's learned to swim. He's like a tiny little, no pun intended, he's a tiny little fish swimming in sort of this social ocean of sharks.
Yes.
And somehow he's been able to navigate the waters and stay alive long enough and do well enough, socially speaking.
Right.
But at this point, I don't think he's ever experienced anything like this in his life, where he actually, he's actually, like, a lot of his privileges are stripped pretty bare.
Yeah.
He still has his wit. He still has his social education. But he's never been asked to survive like this before.
Exactly. And so that's, again, where we see him employing the strategies that have always worked for him. And some do. You know, you can definitely see in this chapter, the things that have always worked continue to work to a certain extent. But you're right, Anthony, he's in a very, very different environment now. And so some of what has worked before simply doesn't work now. And so he now has to come up with new strategies and new tactics and new forms that involve things he's never really had to employ before. And part of that is just new forms of cleverness, right? New forms of humor, but it's also a new kind of physical strategy. And, you know, even for somebody with all of Tyrion's privileges and advantages, which we can talk about, the fact is that, you know, this world is extremely hostile to anyone living in it. You know, it's not a forgiving environment. And so even somebody like Tyrion, who was born to wealth and privilege and nobility, you know, just existing in this world has a series of challenges that are really accentuated, I think, given the different environments that he's in and that people in general are in. And you really see that in this chapter. So, you know, I think your point is very valid. And that's part of the reason I love the chapter, because you're right, we now see him in this completely new environment where he does have to come up with new strategy survivals.
Yeah. His wit and, I guess, social education is being tested.
Tested.
In a way that it's never been tested before.
Right.
And who knows? Like, I don't know if he's ever... Like, I know that he probably doesn't have zero martial training, but we do get the sense that, like, that's not really his thing. That's Jamie's thing.
But, you know,
thing.
What's so beautiful about this, and we can jump to, you know, the battle scene, is that he is greatly disadvantaged. Obviously, you're right. He did have some training. Just as a child of nobility, he would have had some training at arms. There's a section in the book where he refers to he had some tumbling training.
That's right.
And of course, his father, you know, cuts that off. But how useful I think that tumbling training becomes, because he is able to use his short stature and the fact that nobody expects anything of him physically to huge advantage here. You know, he comes up from behind. He comes up from below. Nobody kind of sees him coming.
Yeah, he's like darting rock to rock.
He's darting rock to rock. Right. And he becomes like this ninja warrior in ways that no one ever could have anticipated. And I think in ways he himself is shocked by.
Uh-huh.
That, wow, you know, in most settings, my height is a great disadvantage. But in this particular battle, they don't see me coming.
Right.
And so he's able to employ that in ways that, again, allows him to survive and allows for the survival of others. He saves a couple lives here.
Right. Let me read the short synopsis of the chapter.
Okay.
And we can talk more about the battle. Tyrion is bound and on his way to the Eyrie. The ride has been hard on him, made worse by bound hands and a hood over his face. He hits a low point when one of Catelyn's men butchers his horse for meat. He reflects back on the night of his capture and admires the wit and cunning of Catelyn Stark. After a short exchange with Kat about the true nature of Peter Baelish, her little band of misfits is waylaid by a mountain clan. A battle ensues. In the chaos, Tyrion is unbound and given an axe. Several men are struck down, but Tyrion, Kat, Bronn, and a few others survive. For fear of a second wave of the battle, the group presses upward into the Vale, leaving several men unburied on the side of the road. So, Jan Wilson, do you want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
Well, I thought it would be interesting to talk about these various strategies, Because again, you know, the thing I love about the chapter is you see almost all of them being employed here. And so we could kind of break down, you know, what these strategies are, how Tyrion variously uses them, both in the chapter and, you know, kind of as a whole throughout his arc. Because I think it's so interesting to first start with this idea of privilege.
Sure.
Right? I mean, no one is, you know, completely kind of on the side of privilege. No one's completely on the side of oppression. We all occupy various locations within these systems. And I think that you can see, first of all, that Tyrion has always, this is kind of his default setting, right? I'm a Lannister. My father is the most powerful lord in the kingdom. And so you better treat me well.
Right.
Plus, if that fails, I have money. And so, you know, you constantly see him falling back on this, which again has worked pretty well.
Kind of looking around at the sellswords and saying, you know what? My father might reward the man who brings him certain information about my capture, wink, wink.
Yes, he does it in two ways, right? So on the one hand, let me try this. Let me try the carrot.
Sure.
Right. So he'll say, you know, in the previous scene where he's at the tavern and he's first abducted by Kat, oh, my father would be very interested.
Right.
You know, like you just said, Anthony, he'd be very interested to know any information, or perhaps, you know, someone who aids me might be rewarded handsomely. When that fails, of course, then he goes to the stick. Well, you know, my father is the most powerful lord in the kingdom and a very vengeful person, by the way, will do anything to defend the honor of his house. So, you know, he's coming for me. And so he shifts back and forth between those two kind of positions constantly throughout the book. And certainly, you know, you see hints of that in this particular storyline, as well as the chapter itself. And that, again, has worked pretty well for him. Doesn't work quite so well in this particular chapter. They're a little more influenced by what Kat is telling them, you know, by her family name and the loyalty that they feel to her family, and certainly the reward they're hoping for when they get to the Vale. So it's not quite there, but he's laying the groundwork.
Right.
He's kind of reeling them
in. So he leans on that sort of, he leans on not just his wealth, but the reputation of his wealth, right?
Yes.
But in addition to that, he's also, you know, his social education has also given him enough sense to know, to tell one of his guardsmen to put down his sword. Like, they're in the inn, and I think it may be Jick, I forget which one it was, but one of his guardsmen unsheaths his sword when there are 12 men trying to, and basically he says, our gracious host has asked us to put away our swords. Let's go ahead and do that out of courtesy.
Yeah.
And it's his way of saying to Catelyn, you've got me and I don't want to die. Right.
So, yes. He's smart. He's very pragmatic.
Right. Whereas I could see someone like Jon Snow, like, not quite doing it as delicately as that.
Or somebody like Ned, right? I mean, these are characters who, you know, at least when we're, you know, first introduced and throughout most of the, especially for Ned, of course, who doesn't have much of a story arc, poor Ned, but, you know, especially for John in the early books, it's, you know, kind of this ride or die mentality. It's this idea of I will die on my honor. And Tyrion's much more pragmatic about it, as is his father. You know, Tywin, how long did he hold back, you know, before sending his troops to King's Landing, you know, in the Battle for the Throne? He was waiting to see who would win.
That's right.
And Tyrion, I think, is exactly the same way. He certainly has maybe more nobility than his father in terms of his motivations, but he's extremely practical. And he also gets, what I found really interesting in rereading the chapter, he also, despite his maybe more noble intentions, he has inherited his family's desire for revenge. He can be very vengeful. Yeah. I love the part where he is memorizing the names of his captors.
Yeah, because he's going to have to pay them back.
He will pay. It's kind of a hint of Arya, right? Uh-huh. I'm going to say their names every night. Mm-hmm. And that way I'll be sure to reward them. And of course, in this sense, it doesn't mean monetary reward. Mm-hmm. It means vengeance.
That's right.
Which I thought is an early hint at, you know, what we will see later in the books from Tyrion.
Right. So I want to ask you a question. And I mean, I'm sure this could go any number of places, but I don't know what your answer will be to this.
Okay.
I'm going to read this. After that, things ran together. The dawn was full of shouts and screams and heavy with the scent of blood, and the world had turned to chaos. Arrows hissed past his ear and clattered off rocks. He saw Bronn on horse, fighting with a sword in each hand. Tyrion kept on the fringes of the fight, sliding from rock to rock, darting out of the shadows to hew at the legs of passing horses. All right, just a quick observation and then to my question. We're almost at the midway of this book, and I don't think we've seen sort of a medieval battle scene yet.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of Martin finally throwing a little bit of blood and action into this adventure story, right?
Yeah.
And he's pretty good at it.
Yes.
So far, this book has been about intrigue and dialogue and characters' motives and, conflicting contexts and whatnot, and humor at times. But we haven't seen Martin do this in the book yet.
Right.
All right. So here's my question to you. As I read this, how much should I care about authorial intent? Mm. You know, back when I was in university in the 90s, it was sort of hit into my head that this business about like studying the life of the author and trying to divine the mind of the author,
yeah,
is sort of a fool's errand. What we should be doing is sort of exploring the life of the text.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's been a long time since those days. So I'm wondering, let's say we're sitting in your classroom, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, should I care about the author's intent? What sort of advice would you give me?
Can I ask you a question before I answer?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you select that particular passage as a way of opening mm-hmm. this conversation?
Because I think Martin is something of a pacifist.
Mm.
And I think that he has this view of warfare that it is chaos, that it's foolish.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but should that matter? You know, should it matter to me that this horrific, bloody chaos that's beautifully written has been beautifully written by someone who has a particular ideological view on violence?
Yeah. It's interesting you should ask me this at this particular moment. If I could do a little bit of a... It's not a non sequitur, it's more of a segue, and then I'll come back.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I am getting ready to teach for the fifth time, I believe, a course on Harry Potter.
Uh-huh, okay.
I am heavily involved right now in kind of revamping the course and gathering new materials, especially in light of some of the new revelations we have about J.K. Rowling.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you, I'm sure, are aware, probably most people listening to this are aware of some of the troubling tweets that she sent out and some of the opinion pieces that she published last year
mm-hmm.
That were very hurtful and offensive to many people, but particularly those in the transgender community.
Right.
So without going into a long tangent about that, I am sort of... not struggling, but kind of deliberating over how to use this controversy as a way of talking about what you just raised, this idea of authorial intent. How much should the author's intent, the author's hand on the page, matter to us as readers? Can we ever separate the author from the creation?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have my own thoughts about this. I'm kind of like you, Anthony. The way I was trained in school was the death of the author perspective.
Right.
Right. That, you know, once something is published, once something is out there, it really doesn't belong to the creator anymore. It belongs to the readers.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of a story like Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or anything that has become so popular, I think one huge reason for that popularity is because readers can make of it what they want. They can build their own interpretations and stories and fantasies or interpretations in whatever way is suitable to their own subject position, mm-hmm. To where they are in life, how that changes over the course of your life as a reader. When I first started teaching those books, the first class I taught on Harry Potter was back in 2010. And so the students I was teaching in that generation, they had grown up with Harry Potter. They were the same age as Harry Potter. They went to the midnight, you know, screenings. They mm-hmm. went to the bookstore to get their books. They went in costume. When the last Harry Potter book came out, I had so many students say to me, I felt like my childhood just ended.
Right.
That this coming of age moment is just gone. Yeah. It's over. But the students I teach now, which is kind of scary to think about, you know, these students were born in the early aughts. Yeah. They were born, I mean, they were babies when Harry Potter was ending. Mm-hmm. And so they have just a very different relationship to it. And they also have a very different relationship to issues of social justice.
That's right.
And diversity and inclusivity. And, you know, the way in which they interpret these books is going to be so different than how that earlier generation, you know, from how that earlier generation. So that's a big tangent and a way of saying I tend to fall much more on the side of it's really what the reader brings to it. It's interesting. I'm an historian by heart, mm-hmm. by training. It's fascinating to look at Martin and his, you know, background and his beliefs and his process of writing the books, where he was, how he feels about, you know, the filmic adaptations. I love that stuff. I love reading that stuff. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, why I enjoy these stories, why I keep coming back to these stories and revisiting these stories is because of what I bring to them as a reader and how each time I revisit, you know, just you and I in preparing for the podcast today, every time I revisit these stories, I see something new in them and I find new interpretations because I've changed. I'm at a different place in my life journey or my education or, you know, how I think about the world or what's happening in the world. Some of the things are the same, but I see such different things every single time. And for me, that's the best part of it. Mm. That's the most important, I think, part of it, as opposed to, well, what did the author mean? What did the author think? What was the author's intent? That's interesting, but it's not the most interesting thing for me. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm glad that I'm curious. I didn't think we'd be talking about Harry Potter today, but it's a.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean.
No, it's fantastic.
Harry Potter is on my brain right now.
So my daughter is 17, and she was an early reader.
Yeah.
And a lot of her childhood was spent moving place to place because I was an adjunct professor, and I would just we were all over the country.
Sure.
And every time we would move, she would reread Harry Potter.
Oh, wow.
It was almost like my friends are gone, but I still have Harry and Hermione and Ron. Oh, wow. Right? So it was like this bastion of comfort for her.
Sure.
And it was like clockwork. It's like, okay, we've been here 18 months. Let's move again. You know, that kind of thing. And then she would jump into those books again. And in her childhood, she read through those books 7 times.
Wow.
I
should invite her to come speak in my class.
Oh, yeah. So for her, and she, you know, as a child, she doesn't have the benefit of, like, you know, a university English class where we talk about the death of the author. What would that even mean to, you know, a 7-year-old, right?
Right.
So it was for her, with her sort of her generation's progressive sensibilities, I think it was painful for her to realize J.K. Rowling, who was so important to her, is a flawed person. You know, and you know, that I guess that shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone, like that people are ideologically different in ways that are painful to us. Right.
Right.
But
and that's part of that process of, you know, discovery and growing up. And I mean, that's a major theme of Harry Potter. His idols fall.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like you said with your daughter, that has meant so much to her and has marked so many stages of her life and has provided solace and comfort at times when she needed that. And are we going to let somebody like Rowling take that away?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying one perspective is wrong or one's better. I'm just saying it's fascinating to kind of step back and look at how, you know, different people are responding to
it. Now I have a little confession to make here. I know all of the good and sound arguments for the life of the text over and against the intention of the author.
Yeah.
But I can never turn my brain off.
Right.
I'm never able to not wonder somewhere in the back of my mind, you know, what is it like for a pacifist to write a passage like this?
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess the issue for me is there's part of me that can't stop wondering about those things, even though I know it's probably not beneficial for me to do that.
But I think it is. You know, what you just said, I think, illustrates that. As painful as it is to recognize that those we've admired and whose works we love are deeply flawed human beings, that in itself is a useful thing to know and to learn from, despite how horrible it can be.
Well,
and how disillusioning it can be.
I'm glad this has been such a rich conversation. I really did want to ask you that question, because it very well could be that the tendency to I hate the term cancel culture. I hate it.
Yeah.
But there is a tendency to withhold forgiveness from people who have made really horrific missteps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet I think that that does stand, that tendency, that sort of zero tolerance tendency, does stand in tension with the idea that authorial intent, it's not where the interesting parts of the conversation are.
And these are conversations we usually only have within academia. And I'm interested in seeing how this plays out now in the wider culture. And I think it does relate to this idea of canceling somebody. And what do we mean when we say we're canceling? And what kinds of dialogue is taking place on a social media platform where there really is no room for nuance. There's really no room for the most part, meaningful, intense, complicated dialogue about these issues. And that's another whole, you know, conversation. But, you know, you took us down this path, Anthony.
I know I did. there's so many rich directions we could go.
But going back to your point about the battle scene, you know, I've got this page open in my edition here, and you're on to something. If we want to go back to this idea of intent, it is interesting to look at how Martin doesn't shy away from just how horrific battles are and how bloody they are. And just, you know, the opening up of bodies and wounds, and, you know, at one point Tyrion's entire nose is lopped off in battle.
Right.
And, you know, certainly the filmic version of Game of Thrones gives us a lot of gore and bloodshed, but not to the extent that you see it, especially with our heroes, you know, like Tyrion. You don't see it to the extent that you see it in the text.
Well, in addition to that, and this is maybe where the life of the text is more helpful to us, Tyrion acts heroically. I mean, this chapter, he's given an opportunity, probably for the first time in his life, to choose to act in a way that will not benefit him. Like, politically, it might benefit him for Catelyn to die. And yet he decides that he's going to, you know, fight and kill and, you know, chop logs that bleed, as he says.
Right.
And in a way that sort of piques that sense of heroism in me. You know, it's like, yeah, here he is. He's you know, he's never held an axe before, but now he acquits himself pretty well with an axe. And look, he's, you know, he's rescued the fair maiden. You know, there's some sort of deep, deep down sense of, like, you know, heroism that's peaked.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you this, Anthony, because I've read a couple of different interpretations of that scene where he saves Catelyn. And by the way, what an interesting bit of foreshadowing here when Catelyn Stark stepped up behind the man who attacked her and opened his throat, right? I thought, ooh, we're going to see that again. But a couple of the interpretations I've read is one, you know, Tyrion's not really thinking. Of course, his first thought is, you know, let them have the bitch, as he says, mm-hmm. welcome to her. Great. This is my way of not only getting rid of my captor, but mm-hmm. a bit of revenge as well. But then, of course, he finds himself moving, as you said, logs that bleed, right? And he goes in and he helps save her. Mm-hmm. Does he do it because he's a good person? That instinct kicks in. I'm not going to let somebody be butchered if I can do something to prevent it. Or is he still thinking in terms of self-interest, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That, okay, if Catelyn dies, I'm left out here in the wild. How will I get to where I need to be? Mm-hmm. How will I find shelter? Who will kind of help provide for me? Will I be left to the mercy of these men who probably will just kill me and move on, mm-hmm. right? So what do you think maybe is his motivation there? Do you think maybe it's a bit of both?
So I'm so glad that you said this. So in my view, Tyrion has an inner voice that isn't quite the same as his public voice.
Yeah.
I mean, they overlap for sure. But for instance, in this chapter, you know, he's making this sort of revenge list, right? That's part of his inner voice that he, you know, he may or may not act on. He has this little part of him that like wants to jump out behind the rock and yell Casterly Rock and like,
oh, I laughed so hard.
Jump into the fray of battle, right? But then he doesn't act on it. That little inner voice, he's able to say, I'll think better. I'm going to think better of this situation. He has the inner voice that, like you said, like let the bitch die or whatever. But then he doesn't act on that either. And to me, the way that I read that is I think he's got an inner voice that's kind of an asshole. And so do I. I mean, how many of us can claim that we don't have those kinds of dark thoughts from time to time? And then, of course, you know, having any kind of moral character, you learn to sort of ignore that part of your, you know, inner asshole.
Right.
So I think, I mean, my sense is that there is sort of this Venn diagram between Tyrion's inner asshole and sort of the face that he shows to the world.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, could I give you an accurate reading of my own Venn diagram? I don't think I can.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I feel raw or tired and I snap, and then all of a sudden that inner asshole is like out there in the world. I've got to deal with the consequences of it, right? So I don't know. I feel like the other part of the inner voice thing is that sometimes it will come in and make sense of something you've done. So I think it's like Bronn who says, well, now that you've tasted blood, you need a woman now, right? And Tyrion says, well, I'm willing if she is. And he gets these sort of men of war to laugh, right?
Yeah.
So he gets them to laugh, and then his inner voice jumps in and says, ah, that's a start.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, did he just go for a laugh because he likes to make people laugh? And then the question is after that, now that he's got them to laugh, now how do I use that for political leverage?
Yeah.
So
that's such a good point.
I think a lot of times Tyrion will act, and in the case of Catelyn, I think he does like this little, There's something about sort of what's the heroic thing to do. I'm going to act on that. But then once he's done that, that inner voice is absolutely going to reorganize his thoughts and say, okay, now how can I use this situation to my advantage? Because he is, you know, at his core, he is a survivor.
Yeah. I think that's such a good point. There is that kind of, I don't want to say lapse because it makes it sound as if it's faulty somehow, but there's that inner voice and then there is the action. And I think for Tyrion, most of the time, he is able to pause long enough between the two mm-hmm. to recognize what is the best course of action, not right. necessarily the right course of action, but the best mm-hmm. course of action that will get him to where he needs to be. And it doesn't always happen that way for Tyrion. I forget what passage I was reading the other night where it's not in this chapter, but he keeps saying something and his inner voice is saying, you really should probably shut up right now, but he can't stop himself. He keeps saying it. Do you remember that section I'm talking about? So the inner voice is saying, slow down, Tyrion, but he just keeps going. But most of the time for Tyrion, you're right. I mean, how many times is he sitting in front of Tywin and longs to hurl his wine in Tywin's face, mm-hmm. but he doesn't,
That's right?
He holds back, but he's thinking the entire time, I hate you. I loathe you. You're terrible.
That's
but
right.
He always usually speaks pragmatically. The other thing you mentioned, which I think is so interesting about this chapter, and we see so many hints of this, is he is so funny. There are so many times either in his inner voice where I just kept writing, ha, mm-hmm. you know, in the margins, mm-hmm. or he says things that are meant to be humorous, but there's always that kind of edge behind them.
Yeah.
Right. There's always that kind of deeper motive behind his humor. And so he has gotten very used to either using humor as a way of calling out how he's being treated, right? Mm-hmm. The discrimination that he constantly faces. To point out somebody else's flaws, right? Tyrion just has this brutal truth.
Right.
He just puts it all out there, and he's able to do that because he's the first to tell the truth about himself, right? You can only mm-hmm. tell the truth to somebody else about themselves if you're willing to do that for yourself. And so he does this with John, right? When he first
right.
meets John,
sure.
These conversations, he says, this is who you are. Guess what? This is who I am. You want to join the Night's Watch? Look who these people are.
Right.
This is what you've gotten yourself into.
These are your new brothers.
Accept it,
right?
He does this constantly, right? As a way of revealing these larger truths about other people and himself. But then he also, as you just said, Anthony, and again, you see all of this in this chapter, he also does it as a way of amassing power,
mm-hmm.
right? Gaining an advantage. And so you're right. He says to Bronn, I'll take Catelyn after he says, you know, you need a woman. The minute the men laugh, he thinks, aha, right?
Yeah.
If I can't win them over right now with gold,
mm-hmm.
If I can't, you know, employ these other strategies, I'm getting them to laugh.
That's right.
I'll use that as a way of reeling them in. And you see this, especially in the subsequent chapters, but it's that new kind of, okay, here's another survival technique.
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, here's something else I can use.
Mm-hmm.
And so he always has, you know, regardless of anything that's going on, part of it is just he reads, he knows things, right? He has spent his life poring through books and interacting with people and learning what works and what doesn't. But he's also so smart because he knows how to adapt, you know, like that fish you were talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just rely on the same old things. Sometimes he does. But in this chapter, he's realizing, oh, here are a couple of other things I can use. I'm pretty good at battle because they don't see me coming. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty good at, you know, reeling in Bronn and these other men by being one of the guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, by making a sexist joke.
That's right.
It's so interesting to see how he just adapts and survives as he goes along.
There's one more thing about the inner voice that caught my attention, and that is early in the chapter, he's sort of lamenting the loss of this horse.
Yes.
And there's this little passing thought that maybe the horse has the better of the situation.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like one of these things, like you could read that as a joke that's meant to amuse him. You know, it could be he's telling himself a joke to pass the time. But we know that he will become suicidal in these later books.
Yeah.
And that sort of ideation will become a dominant part of the inner voice.
Right.
And so it's hard to, I don't know. I don't know if this is a little seed that maybe suicidal ideation is sort of part of that inner voice. But knowing where his character goes toward, I think it's maybe the beginning of Dance, that inner asshole will eventually take over because
yeah.
because he's laid so low that he just lets that inner voice run amok, really.
Yes, I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, again, the chapter hints at these things that we will see later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Book Tyrion, I think it's really after the, you know, the third book that Book Tyrion and Show Tyrion really start to depart. And it's not just that kind of, you know, suicidal ideation, which I think you're absolutely right. I think we do see an early hint of that here. But it's just that bitterness and desire for vengeance. Mm. Only if you're a book reader do you really get that from Tyrion, how dark, you know, Tyrion gets. And I was struck with this the other night. You know, I mentioned earlier in our conversation about how it's funny, his list of, you know, his enemies list. Right. I laughed out loud again when I, you know, read about him just sitting there and memorizing the names and thinking about how they would be mm-hmm. handsomely rewarded someday. But that's a hint at that darker nature that comes out later when I think, have you read, maybe I should say spoiler alert. I don't know how many people listening to this will have read the little excerpt from Winds of Winter, but we know that he is off to find Daenerys, right? Toward mm-hmm. the end of his story mm-hmm. arc. And you can take anything out, Anthony, that I'm going to say that you don't want me to say, but.
Yeah, no, I spoilers are welcomed on this.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what I was thinking about is how, you know, he sets off to find Daenerys. And if you're just a show watcher, if you haven't read the books, in the show, it's depicted as he's looking for a better world. You know, he's looking for a better political system. Mm. He's looking for a savior. You know, he's looking for somebody who breaks the wheel, mm-hmm. who doesn't do things the way it's always been done. And in the book version, we very much get this sense that actually, you know, his motivation is he wants to just go back to King's Landing and kill everyone. Right. He wants to go after those who have humiliated him, who have taunted him, who have treated him terribly, who have reduced him to what he is. You know, he's even angry at Jaime at that point. He is looking for vengeance. Mm-hmm. And you really get that kind of darker aspect to his nature, not only in terms of his attitude and his demeanor and his that inner voice that leads us to that conclusion, but in the very language that he uses. And so it's going to be really interesting to see mm-hmm. where we go. I think George at one point even described Tyrion as the villain of the story, did he not? And here we go back to author's intent, right? Huh. Are we meant to understand that Tyrion's our villain because George said it that he is? I don't know where I'm going with this, but I find it really interesting that we do get this early kind of nature of Tyrion. That kind of you definitely see him warring with this in the early books, between, you know, his desire for vengeance, his desire to lash out at those who have been so cruel to him, warring with this nature of, well, I still want to do the right thing. And you see that in his rescue of Kat, his first instinct, I think, understandably, you know, this woman who has captured right. him and who's accusing him of these things that he hasn't done, his first instinct is, you know what, let her die.
Yeah.
But then he feels he finds himself moving almost against his will. He finds his body moving mm-hmm. and going in and coming to her aid. So you see both aspects of that. And I think you're quite right to point out maybe it's not even conscious, right?
Yeah.
It's just he is in that moment. But we see both of that in Tyrion. And that's what makes him such an interesting character. He's so multi-layered.
Yes. I mean, I would even go so far as to say I've rarely read a character in a fiction that is as multi-layered as Tyrion.
Yeah.
He's really quite a remarkable feat of literature. And then there is that question about, like, how do I deal with these villainous acts? I mean, there are times when I think, am I right to love this character as much as I do? Uh-huh. Because I know what he's going to do to Shay, you know?
It's yes. like, and how often in a story do you see a character like Tyrion, right? The world is full of point of view characters like Jaime,
right?
Yeah. Until Jaime's arc changes. But how often do you see a character like Tyrion, who is not only a central, maybe the central part of the story, but we see the story from his point of view. Mm. And that's what drew me in really early on. with these books is that we're seeing it from his point of view, as well as the point of view of many different characters. But, you know, especially Tyrion, who is unlike any other character I had seen at that point. And, you know, we all are probably very familiar with, you know, how dwarves are characterized, you know, in literature. Many people are first introduced to people with dwarfism through fairy tales. Right. And they're the comical character. They're the Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. You know, that's how most people come to their understanding. And, you know, Tyrion doesn't fit that mold. But it's also
He does in certain ways. Like, every now and again, like, Martin will, like, hint toward... Like, I was reading Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming, and one of the things that she says about Tyrion is that if you look at this Norse mythology, you know, sometimes dwarves will show cunning. Absolutely, that's Tyrion. Ingenuity when it comes to craft. So he's able to make a saddle for Bran, so that's part of his talent. Yeah. And then every now and again, you'll see a dwarf in fantasy literature carry an axe. And, of course, he's given an axe in this. But every now... So it's like George will, every now and again, tip his hat to these previous sort of typical depictions of dwarves in the medieval world. But it seems to me that he does that in service of some sort of later subversion of the trope.
Yeah, I think that's very well put.
So, I don't know. I found that.
And again, it's from Tyrion's point of view, right? Yes. Why is Tyrion wielding an axe? Because he's in battle and has to survive. And look at how he wields it. I think you're absolutely right. I think there are intentional references to these very common tropes that we see again and again and again, but they're used in ways that are so different from what we've typically seen. And again, from the point of view of the actual character. Which is pretty unique, especially for the time he was writing.
Well, Jan, this has been lovely. I love diving as deep into this story.
Oh, as do I. This is a treat.
Yeah, it's great. Well, here's what we'll do. We will absolutely have to revisit this conversation later in the narrative.
Yes, I would love that. If, like I said, Jamie, Cersei, really any character, please count me in, especially the Jamie sections. I just would love to continue our conversation. This is, like I said, a great treat. This is fun. I don't have a lot of Game of Thrones fans in my household or my community.
Oh, is that right?
So I rely on people like yourself and this great online community podcast and all of these things to kind of feed my obsession here.
Glad to be of service.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I covered The Lion and the Rose. This is the famous purple wedding episode. So that's going to dominate this conversation. But elsewhere in this episode, Mel and Shireen end up having that famous faith conversation. And Tyrion tries to get Shay out of town. And Joffrey brings in the play of The War of Five Kings that includes the dwarf actors. And of course, we know what happens to Joffrey in the end. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, he was just too beautiful to last. He died doing what he loves.
Grossing me out.
Just being a total shit to everybody.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, man, I was not ready.
Last night, when you said, I'm blowing past, I'm going to episode two, I thought, oh boy.
I had no idea what I was getting into, man.
And I couldn't say anything. It's not like
no,
I could
I know.
Say.
Well, so. it was kind of nice because, you know, with the Red Wedding, I knew the Red Wedding was a big deal, right? So I knew it was coming, that it was going to be a big deal. And so I was braced. So this was great to just have, like, just a nice, solid, visceral, like, what? Now?
Yeah.
Oh my God, so gross. Because I'm like, well, maybe he's going to be okay. And then I was like, ah.
talk about a transformation of someone's face.
Yeah. Well, and what's fascinating, too, is because, I mean, that episode was a relentless Joffrey episode of just him being so like, God, I fucking hate this guy. You know? Oh my God, how do you? And then they just kill him, and you're like, whoa, what?
We've talked a lot about the way that they've structured these seasons, right? So this seems like an episode 9.
For
right?
sure. Yeah. I mean, this is a big, I mean, it could be 9 or 10, right? Or like what I would say is this would be the 9, 10 would be whatever the aftermath is with Tyrion. Mm-hmm. And then you leave off with some sort of a cliffhanger for his fate, right?
Like, well, yeah. So I think the idea is that, okay, we've got sort of a rule of 3 going on. Like everyone's expecting episode 9 to be the big thing.
Right.
So to throw this at us, like episode 2, that, I mean, right there, like you said, you weren't ready for it. Really, no one was ready for it.
Even when it was happening, I wasn't ready. I wasn't thinking, like, I'm like, I thought, okay, maybe he's just choking and or maybe he is mildly poisoned and they're able to deal with it, right? Like, I mean.
Yeah.
And then now that, like, sets up this whole notion of, like, oh, well, he's in danger and. But no.
Well, they also set up this budding conflict between Joffrey and Jaime.
Right.
Where Joffrey's just totally ridiculing Jaime and Jaime's just taking it. And you just know, like, that's your dad, dude.
Right.
Like, that's your dad. Not only is he your dad, but he could straight murder you.
Right. Yeah.
And so you're sort of like, that's building. And you're thinking, well, that's getting juicy. And
yeah. So you're thinking long term.
Yeah. Done.
Nah, not at all. Not even a little
all
bit.
All over. So, yeah. So tell me I want to hear your, do you miss Joffrey? I know that you miss Joffrey.
I do. I mean, I don't miss looking at him, but for all the things we just talked about, like Joffrey is in many ways the necessary evil, right? I mean, the same way that Rob would have been perceived as the necessary good. Joffrey is the fly in the ointment. Like, it just complicates everything, because that's one of the things that's the most fascinating about Joffrey is, you know, sure, he's impetuous, he's naive, he's homicidal, he's all these things, and he's the king. And that's what makes it so fascinating, is because you have all these other better players. You mm-hmm. have the Tywins, you have the Jaimes, you have the Tyrians, you have anybody, even Cersei for that matter, but they're all just, you're playing with, you know, as like in Lost, wet dynamite. You know, it could go off at any mm-hmm. time, and then you're beholden to it, right? I mean, and that's the whole sequence, is that nobody can do anything when he's up there just tormenting Tyrion, and nobody likes it. Like, I mean, maybe Cersei, but like nobody really likes it because it's
totally uncomfortable.
Well, it's uncomfortable, and it's sending it, the message it sends is not like, I mean, like Marjorie's trying to kind of rehabilitate the position and the perception, right? And so if he's up there just being cruel and at a minimum childish, mm-hmm. This is not a leader that worth following, and that's the whole thing she's trying to build, right? She's trying to build a following more than just a leadership and name only. And so this is undercutting all of that. And it was just relentless, his chopping up of the book. And then it's the whole cupbearer thing. And then he brings out the little play, which, by the way, I mean, you know, you could do a whole spinoff on those guys. And
well, I'll tell you this. We're not going to do this in the show, so you won't really get this. But in the books, Tyrion ends up with, like, this traveling roadshow with this other little person where he gets reduced to doing that sort of thing.
Interesting.
And the show never does that with
as a result
character.
Of what?
Well, I can't tell you that.
Oh, Steve. Okay.
But the show never goes that direction with Tyrion.
Interesting.
And so he kind of, in the books at least, he gets to see what his life would look like, you know, growing up without any prestige.
Gotcha.
All right. So before we move on, what was Heather's reaction?
She's similar to mine. I mean, she's just like, could we pan away from the face? Like, I
the
get
face, it was like, there was like a good, like, it felt like solid 3 hours on the face.
Yeah, it felt like an entire commercial for that face.
All right. So Tyrion picks up the cup. He's mm-hmm. clearly holding the cup. He was officially his cupbearer.
Yeah.
Pronounced by Joffrey. Yeah.
And I'm seeing this whole like setup, and this is where I get a little bit like, guys.
Okay. All right. However, all right. So let's just call it out. Tyrion's the one guy who didn't do this, right? He's like the only person. Like everyone else there probably has a motive for killing Joffrey, except for maybe Cersei or whatever.
Right.
But you almost kind of feel like you're really not sure what Cersei would be willing to do.
Right. Especially after she's having this whole breakdown in this episode.
This is one of those like whodunits, but you know who is not going to be the murderer is the first person that everyone suspects, right?
Right. And watching the whole thing go down, there was such a reluctance to give him a cup. Why would he? Right. He would have jumped right into the situation had this been premeditated, and it would have to have been premeditated. That's the thing, right?
Yeah, but the thing is about this is that people don't really care about forensics in this world.
That's fair.
People care about, like, well, who can we kill them and it how do we, not come
it's
back on us?
It's closure, whether it's right or wrong. It's just move on to the next thing.
So let's talk about the possible suspects here.
But I guess I have to go back to this, and this is where I'm going to have a little bit of a frustration potential
with
the show, is that they were all there. Everybody's watching this thing go down.
Mm-hmm.
How could he have poisoned him? You know, I mean, it's, and so, yeah, he may be the one that was just then being tormented, but like everybody's watching. It was happening mm-hmm. right. And he didn't go off to get a cup. He didn't go off to get different wine. It was all happening right there.
Well, he's a demon monkey.
Yeah, right? And I guess that's the thing.
And so he's probably, you know, he's probably paid some sort of magician from across the sea to, you know, he's probably had this thing planned for 14 years.
Yeah.
For the people in this world to believe that Tyrion did it, it's not going to take much.
Well, but that's the thing. I could see Cersei and I could see a few others, but like Tywin's face when he just seemed to be like, yeah, I guess it's him, was like very much like that to me seemed a little bit incongruous.
Okay. This, we haven't talked about Shay yet. However, there is the scene where Cersei thinks that she's caught Tyrion's lover, right?
Right.
And he has to pretend that Cersei has the right prostitute.
Right.
And then when he's acting for Cersei's benefit, he says, you're going to pay for this. as soon as you think that something good is going to happen to your life, I'm going to snatch it from you or something like
okay.
that. So because he's protecting Shay, he has basically pantomimed his motive, possible motives to Cersei. And so now, you know, those words came out of his mouth.
Yeah.
And Cersei is always kind of suspected.
Well, that's the result of the life that they've wrought, right? I mean, that's, you've always got to be on guard. You're always waiting for the other one to do the thing because you were always waiting to do the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about possible suspects here. So we know it's not, I mean, we know it's not Tyrion.
Right.
It'd be too obvious. And like you say, there's just no way he would do it.
He's got his own stuff.
I think we both agree that it's probably not Cersei, right?
I would agree.
Tywin is not thrilled.
Well, and the thing is that the thing about Tywin is Tywin's a big picture guy. And he has enough. I firmly believe he knows that Joffrey's not a Baratheon.
Oh, you think so?
I think so. I think Tywin.
He's too smart not to know.
He's seen too much. He knows his children too much. And
see, I think sometimes he's so focused on the legacy that he almost doesn't care who his children are or how they think. Like just cares about who they should be.
Well, I get that. But so that's why I could get the idea that, like, okay, I'll keep up the impression that he's a Baratheon because I can't, because the legacy of the Lannisters is very important. So I'm willing to, at least on the outside, claim that this is a fraud, it's a hoax, he's really a Baratheon. But deep down, he could be looking at long term and go, it's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time before this information gets out. And when it gets out, then it completely unsettles the whole throne situation. I can't have it.
So you're yes or no on Tywin?
I'm saying I would put him on the lower end of suspects, but he's certainly on the list.
Okay. Let's say, imagine we're detectives. We got a bulletin board.
Yeah.
Tywin's picture is on the bulletin board.
He's on the list of people to interrogate. We're not going to interrogate him as if he did it, but we're going to interrogate him. We're going to butter him up to get his knowledge and to see if we can get him to talk about strategy. Maybe he can reveal something.
All right, let's talk about the Tyrells, either Lady Olenna or Margaery.
Okay, so this brings up, before we get into that, I have to ask a question. They're married officially, but is she now the queen? Or is there some sort of a rule about consummation?
I think that consummation's a really big deal.
Yeah, so that's what I had.
And we've already established that by the fact that she never consummated with Renly, right?
Right. And so that's where I got kind of like, well, what is the order of things now? Because we just had this whole very clear discussion with the prince telling former Queen Regent, like really driving home the point that she's lost her title. But then I'm like, well, I don't know how that works. Is she back to being the queen regent? Like, see, that's the thing from
I think it all depends on what the power brokers want, because if they want to set her aside, it'd be super easy to do that. If they want to decide that she's going to marry the next person in line, which is Joffrey's little brother, Tommen.
Right.
Now, we haven't seen a lot of Tommen, but he's like this, he's supposed to be this roly-poly, happy little guy.
He seemed relatively upbeat during the wedding.
So, so you saw the actor who was playing Tommen in the wedding?
Mm-hmm.
Did he look familiar to you?
Yeah, who is that?
Do you remember when the Karstarks ended up killing the two Lannister boys who were supposed to be Tywin's nephews in prison?
Right.
They just ended up bringing back one of those actors.
Okay. All right. I mean, this is the whole Dick York, Dick Sargent episode anyway, or season anyway.
They just decided, yeah, he looks like a Lannister. We'll just bring him back and have him play this new guy. Okay, so it could be that they decide, if they want to set Margaery aside, it'd be pretty easy to do that. If they wanted to just say, okay, yeah, you can marry the younger brother when he's of age or whatever, we'll honor the alliance.
Right.
So that's possible.
That's why I sort of take Margaery off the list.
All right.
Because it's not if there's not a clear, okay, well, she's just now the queen, then I don't see what the advantage is, because everything that I've seen from her is being a queen's a pretty big deal to her. That's her MO. And so the idea that she would risk murdering Joffrey prior to an ironclad stake at the throne doesn't mesh with me. I'm not saying she's not a suspect because I feel like her.
This is going to seem a little bit out of left field here, but Sansa?
Sansa's the one I said last night.
You think it was her?
I don't know that I don't necessarily.
You're going to put her higher on the bulletin.
Oh, yeah, because there is the moment where the cup, she has the cup for sec. And just from a directorial sequence, like you could look at it as a moment where she's sort of compassionate towards Tyrion's endeavors and helps him out. But at the same time, she's spending some time with the jester dude.
Yeah.
And he's like, let's bounce. So then he seems like a possible suspect. But then I'm wondering, is there something in that necklace?
Good eye, man. In the books, the necklace is a big deal. And it's sort of like really played up, like, why is he giving her this necklace? And she's going to wear the necklace in honor. And so maybe there's more to meets the eye with the necklace. With the show, they don't really do as much with that. Okay. Now, I may be forgetting something later in the season. I know that the necklace is important, but I don't think it's sort of like, aha!
Right, okay.
All right, so Sansa's definitely, I mean, look, if anyone had a motive, it's Sansa, right? But the question is, does she have the gumption to do that sort of thing?
Right, and that's why, but that's the thing is where it's like, well, was there more to the fool and hers conversation that we didn't see? That's where I would put her.
Yeah, right. So he sneaks up and says, come with me if you want to live.
Right.
That seems kind of out of nowhere.
It's out of nowhere. It's as if he knows something was about to go down. So he becomes sort of like the obvious, right? I mean, in terms of maybe not for the crowd, but for us as viewers, I would think. Like, he becomes more obvious than anybody else.
Yeah, he's
else.
The only one at the wedding with clearly ulterior motives. Right.
Joffrey wanted to kill him. He's trying to, he basically is doing everything he can to try to like let Sansa know, hey, look, it's you gave me my life back. But at the same time, this is his life. As long as Joffrey is king, this is his life. And it's kind of like, it could go at any time. And while I'm here, I'm just here to be humiliated. He could have potential access to things because he's part of the entertainment. You know, well, from a viewer perspective, I put him very high on the list. But overall, I kind of feel like,
okay, I'm going to bring up one person that's not even in this episode. Littlefinger.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't seen Littlefinger in a minute.
Haven't seen Littlefinger. We will see him soon. But, I mean, here we have a guy who, his motives wouldn't be sort of like, I just can't stand Joffrey and he has to die because he's a monster. Littlefinger would only be doing it if he thought that there would be something to be gained.
Right.
So, it's not above him. He would certainly do something like this. Anyone else that should be on the bulletin board?
Well, the prince.
Oh, Oberyn. Yeah. Oberyn Martell.
Prince Oberyn he's here to complicate things.
Yeah, he's going to wreck shop.
I mean, he has made it very clear that he has a debt to repay.
He wants revenge specifically against the Lannisters.
Right.
And death by poison.
Yeah, you mentioned the poison the last time, and while that may not have been clear in the show, you know, having that discussion with you and I, and knowing a little bit about that from the book now, it's like, well, I mean, this guy seems like he'd have access. It would seem like he's got motive and he's got means.
Now, earlier in the first season, we learned that stereotypically poison is a woman's weapon.
Mm. Yeah, but we've already established, at least right now, that he gender bends. He's a little. He's already made it clear that he doesn't play by the same rules, right? And he's there to buck convention.
I feel like he's the kind of guy that says
he wants you to know.
I want revenge. I want you to know that I did it.
Right. Now that I could see that.
Yeah, he doesn't even care about the game. Even so much so that he's just willing to tell Tyrion, like, yeah, I came here for revenge.
Yeah. Man, Tyrion's whole interaction, I mean, like, Tyrion is so beat down this episode.
Like,
every interaction he has is just like, ugh.
All right, let's talk about Tyrion. Tyrion and Shay.
Yeah. Well, he's genuinely concerned now that their relationship has been officially outed.
It's been outed, so they're both in danger.
Well,
and
she's in danger of being killed.
Yeah.
And he may not be in any more danger other than just having to have her killed.
Or, you know, it could be something horrible, like he's forced to kill her. I mean, you don't know what Tywin's capable of.
Oh, exactly. And then Cersei, if she's helping pull any of the strings.
Yeah. So the best thing for them to do is to run, I think. I think yeah. the second best thing for them to do is for Tyrion to kind of, you know, say, this is our plan. You're going to go hide. I'm going to meet you at a later date. I can't tell you when or whatever. But what he decides to do is like throw rocks at her like she's a puppy or something like that. And I think that they're both too smart and they both kind of see through what he's doing.
Right.
Like, you don't, I know that you really love me. I know that you don't really believe the things that you're saying. And this is all bullshit.
Well, and that's the thing, right? So he, given their interactions thus far, him just saying, look, your life is in danger. He knows she's not leaving. And I don't know if that's just her stubbornness or if it's because she's in love or if, whatever it is. So I think the element of him doing it, and like to your point, the fact that both of them see through it, the fact that she can see that this is what he's resorting to, even if she sees it as a ruse, suggests like, all right, maybe to do this, it would be to have my absolute best interest in mind and convince me this must really be a serious thing. And I feel like that's almost like a code language, so to speak, between the two of them. Well, she doesn't, and she's upset. She doesn't want to leave because of the circumstance, not necessarily because of what he's saying specifically. And so, I mean, that's a major blow to him, right? I mean, that's...
It's well, it seems to be the end of that... It seems to be the end of that stage of their relationship anyway.
Right.
Right.
And also, just as a side note, I mean, what does this do to Sansa? She was already considered the daughter of a traitor. And now she's the wife of the guy who killed the king?
And she runs, right? So yeah. if you know, you look guilty if you run, that sort of thing. So she's got problems.
Because then it looks like, okay, well, maybe they conspired.
And at this point, you're thinking, oh, no, but Dontos will keep her safe. So let's talk about this thing going on with Jon Snow.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of on trial up north.
Yeah. And he's got some swagger now, though.
Okay, good. I'm glad that you're noticing this, because I think he was really sort of just disaffected youth before.
Right.
But he's seen some things, man. He's been in the backseat of a Cadillac. He killed Quorn Halfhand.
Yeah.
He's seen some things.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's amazing how that'll happen. Here's a fun little fact, right? We never watch the opening sequence.
Whenever I watch the opening sequence, I keep thinking, I should ask Steve if he's still
and so,
skipping it.
And so the last episode, I was like, let's give this thing a look. And yeah. Heather's like, well, this is helpful.
Yeah, it's a big map.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah.
And I want you to know that that it changes.
Okay, so that was the question. She's like, do you think it's changing? I'm like, I don't know. We've been skipping it. But I'm guessing that it has, because then she's like, well, what's Dreadfort? And I'm like, I don't know. And then I realize what Dreadfort is after mm-hmm. watching it. And I'm like, oh, well, that's where, you know, that's where Ramsay's
I don't know
if Dreadfort's been there the whole time or not. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think that in the first couple seasons, it didn't change much. Like, it may have added, like, Craster's Keep
gotcha.
a little bit on. But for the most part, it was all the same. But the further we get along in the show, it will change at times.
Okay.
Like, I think for, like, if a castle changes hands, they'll, like, change the flag on the castle. Or if
well,
a castle...
has Winterfell always been smoldering?
No.
Yeah, that's what I kind of figured. I'm like, I bet you that wasn't smoldering the whole time.
And then you have to add stuff like Meereen. Like, we have no idea where Meereen is
right.
until this season or whatever. Yeah, and I, you know, it gets you in the mood.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. I'm a mood guy, and so I think we're going to be watching it now.
I think you're fully in, man.
I guess so, if I'm watching the opening.
You are fully in.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
In my conversation with Jan, we talked about Tyrion's suicidal ideation. On this point, I'll read from what Aaron and I wrote in our books, Gods of Thrones. Previously, we've discussed Tyrion's belief that he's cursed by the gods. On this point, we write, regardless of whether Tyrion is really cursed, he starts to act like it. He descends into suicidal depression, fixating on the worst moments of his life. Tyrion escapes across the narrow sea, like Jonah from Jonah, and wonders if the storm is a punishment from the Father above for kinslaying. There are a number of Jonah parallels here. The most striking are that Tyrion and Jonah are both suicidal. They both travel by boat, below deck, and they both attribute a storm to divine retribution. There are also several important differences between Tyrion and Jonah. We see no evidence of allegory. While in Illyrio's garden, Tyrion fixates on 7 poisonous mushrooms. He pockets them, knowing that they would be lethal if eaten. The number 7 is significant to him. He thinks the 7, the gods of his birth religion, might be inviting him to end his life. This, of course, is from the first Tyrion chapter in Dance. And I bring that out because when we see Tyrion at his most exposed and vulnerable, he has a complicated theology. He's guilt-ridden over his murder of his own father and wonders on the boat whether his father might be sending the storm. He merges the idea of his own father with the archetypal father above, and while drunk, it's a pretty interesting and Freudian conflation between father, capital F, and father, lowercase f. And that's all for this week.